Governor Charlie Crist. But Florida's new governor, Republican Rick Scott, said after looking at the cost and projected ridership, to him, it doesn't make sense.
My job is to represent the taxpayers of the state, and I'm not comfortable that this is a project that we ought to be doing. It's not a project that I'm comfortable is going to get a return for the investors, and I represent the investors of Florida, the taxpayers.
Scott says when he informed Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood of Florida's decision, LaHood was disappointed. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Wisconsin lawmakers are preparing to vote on a plan that pits the state against organized labor. Hundreds of public employees at risk of losing most of their collective bargaining rights are struggling to delay action. But Republican Governor Scott Walker maintains the measures necessary to address Wisconsin's projected $3.6 billion budget deficit. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org.
Within days, Congress will vote on a bill to cut all federal funding for public broadcasting. This would be devastating to WILL. It would put the entire infrastructure of public media at risk, not just the dollars that come directly to us. You've told us that you want to know about the challenges we face and how you can help. Please call your representative today and let him know how you feel about the proposed cuts. Go to WILL.illinois.edu for contact information or call 217-333-7300.
On the next Fresh Air, the co-founder of Twitter, Biz Stone. We'll talk about how Twitter was used in Egypt to help organize the revolution and then to spread democracy movements in other countries. We'll also talk about what he had in mind when he co-created Twitter and what surprised him about how it's turned out. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. In the 20th century, human life expectancy increased by more than 30 years, and that is almost as much as humans gained in the entire span of human existence. And today, there are scientists who believe that an even bigger leap is possible. In this part of Focus, we are talking with Jonathan Weiner. He's one of the country's best-known popular science writers. And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his most recent book. It's titled Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. The book is recently out, published by HarperCollins. And in this book, he profiles some of the scientists who are working in what is a recently rapidly growing field, that is the field of longevity. He profiles people who are convinced that aging is a curable disease. It's quite a fascinating book. You can certainly go out and take a look at it. And as far as this program is concerned, you can call in with questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. You may also send along a question by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Jonathan Weiner, has won the Pulitzer Prize for his writing, also the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the L.A. Times Book Prize. His writing has appeared in a number of places, New Yorker, Slate, Time, New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, New Republic, Scientific American, Smithsonian, and other places as well. He's a former editor at The Sciences, and he currently teaches science writing at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And Jonathan Weiner, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks, David. It's my pleasure.
It is a fascinating topic, and one of the things certainly that must be said here is that as far as we know, going back into the written record, and we could probably expect that it would go back further, the fact that human beings die has always been something that humans have been preoccupied with. And the idea that immortality was something that was within reach seems to be also something that we have always had.
I was really struck by that when I started reading about this very, very ancient subject. It seems as if the moment people invent writing, the first ambitious story that they set down on papyrus or in cuneiform clay tablets is They lay out the problem. Why are we mortal? Do we have to be mortal? Are we always going to be mortal? And they lay out a story, at least, of a quest for the solution. So it goes very, very deep with us, obviously. It's about as deep as we can go in thinking about the big questions.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at human lifespan, it's also striking, as I mentioned here, that from, say, from the Stone Age to 1900, while there was a steady increase in longevity, it was relatively, you know, it went up a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. But the big increase has come since 1900. What happened in around 1900 that we got this really dramatic increase in lifespan?
Well, it's the rise in modern medicine that's made such a difference. And the huge boost came from the invention of antibiotics early in the 20th century. And with that, the life expectancy of babies and the life expectancy of their mothers in labor was overnight dramatically increased. And that made a huge difference in overall life expectancy. In the latter part of the 20th century, though, those gains already having been achieved, the gains became gains in life expectancy in the second half of life, so that if you're already, say, 40 or 50, your life expectancy is considerably better now than it was if you had reached middle age in the early 1900s. Mm.
And I guess overall it's true that the longer you live, the odds are you're going to live longer.
Well, that's true to a point, I guess.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. But when we're talking about extending human life, one of the things that scientists look at is looking at those things of which people die and asking this question, well, for, you know, could we cure heart disease? Could we make sure that nobody would die of a heart attack? Could we cure cancer? Could we make sure that people didn't get Alzheimer's disease? So some of the big things that are the big killers, we theoretically one could eliminate those things. But are we really talking about something beyond that?
That's a really deep question, actually. This surprised me. I'm continually surprised when I think of this, that we don't know what we're talking about here, really. Scientists don't know what they mean exactly by aging. I mean, we all have a general idea of it. Unfortunately, it's always there, you know, in the corner of your mind, if not front and center, that each year you're a little bit older and a little bit you're feeling your age a little bit more after a while. What is that? What change is taking place in the body that makes us eventually, say by 60 or 65 or 70, increasingly likely to get these late onset diseases, the ones you just mentioned, and there are a slew of others. But the biggest risk for cancer, the single biggest risk for cancer is age. Now, what is age that predisposes us, that makes us more likely to get those diseases? That's the big question. If you could do something about whatever is changing from, say, 20 to 60, then you would be combating all those late-onset diseases at once. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus, Jonathan Weiner, he's a science writer, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. Among his books, The Beak of the Finch, and a new one that we're talking about here this morning. The title is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality, which is about a developing field within science, looking at lifespan and trying to answer some of the questions we've already talked about. That is, what happens when people age? And is there something that one could do about that? And if the answer to that question is yes, then how long could people live? And there are certainly individuals here who argue that lifespan of human beings could be maybe in the hundreds. There are people who argue that it could be even longer. And that, of course, raises some questions. We'll talk about those things, too. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, how is it that you got involved in this subject? And I know it's something that you've been interested in for quite a while.
I really have been interested, I would say, all my life. I think all of us are interested in these ultimate questions on some level as soon as we start thinking. But I started thinking about this science of longevity and aging and mortality when I had – when I just began as a science writer, which is back in the early 1980s. And I went to interview an elderly biologist named Maria Rudzinska, who was looking at a tiny single-celled animal named Tocopheria, and she was trying to understand why Tocopheria gets old and dies. She felt that there were a few reasons why it made a good study subject, and she felt that she might be able to understand it better in Tocopheria than in larger, more complicated bodies like our own. But Maria Rudzinska was already in her 80s then when I met her, and it was pretty clear that the problem of aging was advancing faster than her research was advancing, that she wasn't going to win that race. And I found it very poignant that she was pretty much alone in her field. There were very few people studying the problem at that time. Mm. So I followed it, and I followed it, and gradually the field began to heat up to the point that now it's really quite a lively business trying to understand aging and seeing whether we can do something to dramatically extend lifespan. Yeah. And that's just fascinating in itself, that scientists are taking the problem seriously.
I think that's an interesting point, that as you write in the book that, say, 20 years ago, there weren't very many people who were working on this, but now it's very big. Now that may be because scientists find, well, the questions here are really interesting. But it's also undeniable that there are people who feel there is money to be made here.
That's right. That's right. In fact, one of the leading researchers in the field, David Sinclair of Harvard, teaming up with his former mentor, Lenny Guarenti of MIT, has formed a company that was sold to one of the major pharmaceutical houses for up toward $1 billion some time back. So there is obviously there's huge, huge money to be made if someone could find, I mean, even just an anti-wrinkling cream or a baldness treatment is potentially very, very valuable. Or you look at a blockbuster like Viagra. What if you had a blockbuster of all blockbusters that would actually slow aging? So the stakes for researchers just financially are quite high. Yeah. But I think, you know, most researchers aren't thinking in terms of dollar signs. They're fascinated by problems that become at least plausibly accessible in the lab. And this is becoming a tantalizing problem. There are enough hints that it's accessible that that serious scientists like Sinclair and Guarenti are getting into it, more and more of them.
Yeah. There is when you write something like this, I'm sure as a writer, you dream of finding a colorful, exciting, eccentric figure that you can put into your book and hang the story on. And you certainly found one, someone who is kind of at the extremes of the field and yet is pretty compelling, who appears in the book. And this is a fellow named Aubrey de Grey, quite the character. Tell us about Aubrey de Grey.
Well, you're right. I look for a dramatic, interesting character, not necessarily eccentric, but I did find an eccentric in Aubrey. Aubrey de Grey, his full name is Aubrey David Nicholas Jasper de Grey, was born in London and learned computer science in Cambridge, England, at the University of Cambridge. And in his mid-20s, met a biologist 20 years older than himself, Adelaide Carpenter. He fell in love with Adelaide. They got married. And very soon after, he became fascinated not only by biology, but by the thought that biology might be advanced enough now to stop aging. And he's made that his life's mission. He's, as you say, very colorful guy. He's 6 feet tall with a beard down to here, lean as a medieval saint, passionately committed to the cause of ending aging and persuading the rest of us that it's possible, doable in our lifetimes, and also passionately interested in beer. So every conversation with Aubrey takes place in a pub or over a bottle of beer, and really breakfast, lunch, dinner, and beyond for Aubrey consist of beer, and he doesn't see that in any way as contradicting his mission of giving us 1,000-year lifetime.
Yeah. He, for anybody who's curious, and if you do have web access, you just put his name into your browser, and you can find pictures of Aubrey. And he does, in fact, look like somebody who probably should be living in Middle Earth. There's something about him that does look a little unworldly.
Yes, and I think that's partly by design. He once told me when we first met that he said, it suits my purposes to look unusual. And he does, and he has this unusual message that if we rally behind him and his research program, we stand a chance of living 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 1,000,000 years.
And for anybody who might think, well, that's just absurd, it must be said that there are many scientists who are looking at what he's arguing, looking at some of his ideas, and they take them seriously enough so that they say, well, this is indeed worthy of some serious thought and research.
That's right. That's right. And that was part of the reason that I was emboldened to write about Aubrey. I didn't write about him as a disciple or a believer, and I'm not either of those things. And neither are those serious scientists who collaborate with Aubrey. Very few of them subscribe to his belief that the first 1,000-year man is alive today. Mm-hmm. But the possibilities that we might understand aging better in our lifetimes, or even in the next few years, find ways to begin to slow aging, those are real. And Aubrey does have interesting ideas to contribute, and he's published interesting papers with serious, respected gerontologists, scientists who study aging. So he's neither fish nor fowl, Aubrey. In some ways, he's one of these charismatic characters who jumps up in every age. Every generation has an Aubrey who says, we can live forever. I solved the mystery. Actually, every generation has dozens of these people, and I keep meeting them now that I've written this book. I gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y in New York this past Thursday with Oliver Sacks. And as we were talking about longevity and mortality, and Oliver was saying, after all, we are all mortal, someone in the balcony jumps up and shouts, it's a lie. It's not true. And she has a plan for curing aging herself, a very different one involving crazy architecture in which the house is so uncomfortable to live in that just overcoming your day makes you live forever. That's her approach. Yeah. So, there are all kinds of cockamamie approaches to the problem of death. We've always seen people like this. What makes Aubrey interesting is that he is deeply informed about the science of gerontology. He does have valid, if out-of-the-box ideas, and he's helping to stir the pot. He's helping to generate enormous publicity and attention for what may become, conceivably, an extremely important turn in human affairs. Because if we could do this, it would overturn everything. All our institutions, all our expectations, so much of our own sense of what life is changes if you start to imagine that you could have another, say, 50 good years, let alone 500.
Well, I have some callers here. And again, another number of other really interesting questions we'll try to get into as we continue to talk with our guest, Jonathan Weiner. But rather than keep everybody hanging on here, we'll try to get to some callers. And of course, they can help us by being brief. We'll get as many folks in as possible. Starting in with somebody who's listening up near Chicago, apparently, our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love the idea for trying to live as long as you can, but there's one big problem. And actually, I was reading about it today. It just so happens to be that people are outliving their money. There's a big article in the USA Today saying that they're comparing, and what it comes down to, dying 39%. What are you gonna say? Which do you fear the most, dying or outliving your money? And I think that's a big problem in this country, is that there's more people. The more people live longer, the more chances are that we won't have enough money to supply everybody. And, I mean, again, it goes back to, you know, the truth about it would be, okay, the other second thing would be the health system. The health system and your health. I do believe that there's people that can replace, you know, just about any organ in the body almost. But how many times, you know, how many times you're going to get it? How many people are going to be around? Are we going to have organ factories or what? It's kind of spooky when you think about it. It's like a fringe type thing that you'd see on TV or some mad scientist thing. But I'll get off okay. And I'll... you can give me a comment on that. Thank you, guys. Well,
and that what the caller raises the some of the really big ultimate questions that come under the heading: if you could do it, would you or should you? That get at this issue of well, you know, let us suppose what would happen if all the people who had ever been born were still on the Earth. I think we'd have some serious issues. How do people in this field address questions like that?
Absolutely right that these huge. Problems. These huge questions jump to mind the minute you start contemplating this. And I think the should we question is at least as complicated as the could we question, mm-hmm. maybe more complicated. Mm-hmm. So just to address that first worry that your caller raises, would we outlive our money? There's something in there that I think, we assume when we imagine that we had an extra – the gift of another 50 years that we would spend those 50 years frail. We would spend those 50 years in the state of advanced retirement. But that's not the dream, at least, of these gerontologists. What they're hoping to give us is 50 good active years. If they could do that, then – we're not running out of money. We're actually not retiring at 65 or wherever you lay down your sword or your plow. You're going on and you're continuing to till or fight the good fight for an extra half a century. So that issue may not be as serious as you're imagining. On the other hand, think of the struggles we're going through right now, just trying to raise retirement age a little bit, that issue has caused riots in Paris. It's being shouted about in Canada and the United States right now. It's very hard to make even tiny tinkering adjustments to our health system, as our president has discovered, to retirement ages, to all of these huge institutions that we've built around our current life expectancy. So if you turn that upside down, you have tremendous social struggle, and that's inevitable in this project. So I think if you ask the most ardent advocates of life, dramatic life extension, what about this or what about that, the way your caller just did, their answer is it would be such a boon. It would be so good for science to be able to give us all those good years that we just have to go for it and then deal with the adjustments as we can. That's the basic answer.
All right. Another caller. We'll talk with someone in Coles County, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'm, like a lot of other people, I'm totally opposed to this eternal life through via science. And there are a tremendous number of societal problems, many of which have already been mentioned. And by the way, I might mention that even if somebody is healthy enough to work at 150 years old, for example, there's a question of where would the jobs come from? Would there be enough jobs for all those people as they pile up, the population piles up over the years? I have one question real quick. I've had some people say that if this so-called eternal life through science does occur eventually, that it would probably be only available to very wealthy people. Other people, I'm sure, say the opposite, that it would be available to everybody. What is your view on that? Do you think it would be available mainly to the very wealthy or what?
Good question.
Well, Very good question, and I want to say that I share all these concerns. Again, I'm not speaking as an advocate for dramatic life extension. I've just found it fascinating to talk with the people who are engaged in that and think about these questions. I find a little bit more there to agree with than I expected when I first went in. But I remain – I think you nailed one of the biggest issues, maybe the single biggest issue, which is overpopulation. I mean, if we're already struggling with that problem now, where will we be in 50 years if everybody around now and everybody born in the next 50 years is still standing? That's an incredibly difficult problem to – I mean, it's a mind-boggling problem. So, gosh, having said that now, I'm losing track of the question that your caller asked just at the – at the end of that call.
Well, is the caller still there? Do you want to?
Yes. No, I was just asking whether it's likely that the this would be available only
just something
to
for the rich
people, or
right.
whether it would be available to pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's also an excellent objection, an excellent concern to raise. And I don't think there's any doubt that the haves and the have-nots, the gap would between them would widen even more spectacularly than it has already. And that's a deeply disturbing prospect. You can imagine millionaires and billionaires being the first to be able to live 500 years, say, and meanwhile have-nots still seeing their children die of malnutrition at the age of 3 or 4 or 5. So that's a ghastly prospect, and it's very hard to see how that, at least in the short run, how that would be avoided.
I must jump in here. We have some other callers who are at our midpoint, and I would like to introduce again our guest, Jonathan Weiner. He is a well-known science writer. His books have won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the L.A. Times Book Prize. His writing has appeared in a lot of publications, among them The New Yorker, Slate, Time, New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, and he is the author of the book Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. And it is out just recently, and it's a book that, as he has explained, profiles the science and some of the scientists that are looking at the question of human lifespan and asking question, is it possible to extend that, and how much could it be extended? And as he said, there certainly are people who make this argument that it would be possible to extend the lifespan hundreds of years, if not longer. And so what the book is about is looking at some of the scientists and how it is that they're approaching this issue. And if you're interested in reading the book, of course, you can go out and take a look at it. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Mahomet and line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have two things to say. Have you ever heard of the drug Articall, A-R-T-I-C-A-L-L? It's from cows, and it supposedly is a permanent cure for wrinkles. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't, but I know that there are no permanent cures for wrinkles, so I distrust it immediately. One of the oldest medical documents is a papyrus that was written by a scribe on dictation from an Egyptian doctor in the shadow of the pyramids, when the pyramids were first being built. And The scribe was describing all sorts of serious medical conditions on the front of the papyrus, and then seems to have gotten impatient, flipped it over, and on the other side wrote a recipe for anti-wrinkle ointment. And the recipe ends just the way ads for these ointments do today, found effective myriads of times. But we're still wrinkled. And we still wrinkle. And if you look around, you see plenty of wrinkles today. If there were a successful anti-wrinkle treatment, I think we would all know about it. So I'm very wary of these nostrums.
I would have to say when I was in law school, we read about several things that were great, great improvements, and they got bought off. by big companies so that they never hit the market. So I'm not sure you're correct about that. But I did call a pharmacist, and they said, well, they didn't have it, but they could order it. But then I called back, and they said, no, I couldn't order it. So I don't know whatever happened there about that. But I would like to say that I am 78. And I would gladly raise the retirement age a year or two, whatever we have to do, and means test everybody. And I don't think the American people are against that. I think the politicians are just so scared of doing anything that might affect them being reelected. But I think the American people are right on the program about that. I think we all know we're going to have to do this. I mean, there is no other way, and we've known it for a long time, so why don't we just act like grown-ups and do it?
Here, here. I'm right with you there. I'm not in the same camp with you about the idea that there's a cure for wrinkles out there and it's being kept secret by the pharmaceutical houses. I mean, from what I know of these pharmaceutical houses and their executives, if they had something that was worth trillions of dollars, as that would be, they wouldn't hesitate to push it to market as fast as they could.
Well, there are some things that are being looked at as potential life-extending medications, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, there are a few that seem to be promising. I mean, part of the reason that this field has heated up is that it is possible now in the lab to create Methuselahs. If you're looking at fruit flies, say, or you're looking at these roundworms, C. elegans, which are one of the workhorses, so to speak, of laboratory science, you can change one gene and you can make a Methuselah out of one of those flies or worms. And we're all closely enough related on the tree of life that we have analogous genes ourselves. And it's very possible that the kinds of tweaking that are possible in the lab will also have effects on our own longevity if we want to pursue this line of research.
Mm. But
I'm sorry, David.
No, go ahead. No, well, I should not have interrupted you. Go ahead.
Okay. So what's more, I was saying, is that with calorie restriction, which seems to extend the lives of many different kinds of lab animals, the changes that take place in their metabolism are similar to the changes that you see in those genetically engineered Methuselah flies and worms. And that also excites scientists in this field now, because they feel as if they may be converging on some central some sort of hub in the system, or gear in the clockworks, if you like, that might be able to slow down the hands of the clock. Hmm. If they're right, then they really could be on their way to some sort of pill that would slow aging. And that's why the big pharmaceutical house invested in David Sinclair's particular drug of choice, which is known as resveratrol, found in the skins of red grapes and in your glass of wine.
And this was just exactly the thing that I was going to ask you about, because it has apparently been found, or at least there's good reason to believe that fairly serious calorie restriction does indeed slow aging, and that there is, in fact, this drug that you mentioned that mimics that effect. The question, though, I was going for was, do the scientists who are working on this, do they know why it should be that calorie restriction should slow down aging?
Well, we have to be careful, first of all, to say that this is all pretty tentative. Mm-hmm. And the results so far in the clinical trials involving resveratrol are not simple and clear-cut, and we don't really know how it'll sort out. And there have been many, many hopes that have been dashed over the years in clinical trials. So we can't be sure that their hands are reaching for the recipe right now. They may be getting closer, but not there. But what would be involved with resveratrol is some kind of adjustment in the way your cells deal with sugar. And so it could be, in fact, that resveratrol or a drug like it could help with diabetes, for instance. And it may be that somehow if you are adjusting the way the cell perceives how much food, how available nutrients are around it in the environment of the cell, then you're doing to the cell, you're kind of giving it an artificial sense of calorie deprivation, and it responds the way a mouse will to calorie restriction by slowing down in some ways and preserving itself better than it normally does, extending the life of the cell and the mouse and, who knows, perhaps a human being.
All right. Well, we'll continue and take some more calls here and next talk with someone in LaSalle County on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was just curious if you guys, the writer, had considered China in terms of the agricultural revolution of the 20th century and the one-child policy they have. There's 1.2 or 3 billion people in China. There's 3.1 billion or million people here. And we're about the quarter of the size of China, but our economy is greater. But what I'm getting around to say is they have basically, because of the aging of the population of China and the one-child policy, they have their population is aging to such a degree that the mean is getting older and older, and there are fewer and fewer people who are younger to support the elderly, and they're going to hit a wall at some point. And I was wondering if you could comment on that, and I'll just hang on and listen, I guess.
Okay, yeah. It seems okay. Like a lot of people are really – they go straight to the demographic issues that are raised by this research.
Well, and they're huge, and they're already upon us, as your caller has just said. The demographics are ominous because of the gain in life expectancy that we've already had over the last 100 years, and then the huge population experiment in China aggravates the problem. But you see it everywhere. You see it in Europe, for instance. There's a phenomenon that is increasingly on demographers' minds and social scientists' minds called global graying. And it is incontrovertible. I mean, you can see global graying just walking down almost any street in the developed world. We are the so-called baby boom is we're no longer babies. I'm right smack in the middle of that. And we're all graying. We're all getting older. And it's going to be a sort of inverted pyramid. There are going to be more and more old people and fewer young people to support all those old people. So this is another reason I think that the study of aging is becoming more and more important, prominent, talked about, and will continue to be, because we've already got a gift of extra years, and we're already dealing with the curse that comes with the gift.
And that, I think, again, it also comes around to the issue of quality of life, that one can't simply be talking about having people live longer. We also have to be talking about making sure that they're healthy. And not just living longer, but living well longer.
That's right, which involves so much, as we all know. This is a fear, by the way, that goes all the way back to the world's oldest stories, as so much of this does. None of this is new. I mean, what's new is the advance in the petri dish that can engineer the Methuselah fly or worm. But the concerns, the hopes and fears, all of that is ancient. Mm-hmm. So the Greeks had a myth of Tithonus. He was one of the princes of Troy, very handsome guy, and the goddess of the dawn, Aurora, fell in love with Tithonus. And she pleaded with her father, Zeus, to make him immortal. Zeus agreed, but poor Aurora had forgotten to add that he should have eternal youthful life. And so Tithonus got older and older and more shriveled, and at last he turned into a little grasshopper who could do nothing but cheep, cheep, cheep. And she had to put him in a little cage. So that's the nightmare of Tithonus, and that nightmare springs to mind whenever you hear about people giving us another 500 years.
Yeah, all right. I thank the caller to next talk with somebody in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
It's been fascinating. I really enjoy the literature that comes out on this topic. I mean, both between science and science fiction, one which shows what's possible and one that kind of asks what if. One of my favorite that I was curious if you comment on, it's a hilarious title, but it's called The Great Mambo Chicken and the Transhuman Condition. Heard of it?
I have heard of it by Ed Regis.
Yeah,
I haven't read it, but I've always meant to. Yeah,
it's
is it good?
The story of of the evolution of this group of people that are looking to extend life. And there's some very, very good characters in there. For example, Bob Truax, who is an engineer that worked out of JPL, and he has a lot of strange ideas about space travel. But considering that he's a rocket scientist, he can. But his side project was extending the human condition and looking for the stressors that might actually extend life. And one of the most interesting experiments they talked about was several generations of poultry that lived under high gravitational stress. They essentially put two or three generations of chickens into a centrifuge. And they took the chickens out after about four generations. And any of those chickens that was introduced into a normal population, they simply took over. They had increased heart body mass, health, activity. So that was one thing I found was very interesting. And if you could comment, and the second one was on science fiction. And this is one that's kind of like the condition, which is like more the social science. There's a wonderful story about a person that kind of takes these leaps throughout history and finds himself ever more increasingly obsolete. And the question there is my connection about the advances in science. It could be argued that the scientific revolutions of our culture throughout time don't necessarily happen because of the veracity of a given argument. Like, let's say the Earth is not the center of the universe and we actually rotate around the sun. Kepler's ideas didn't necessarily succeed because of their strength, certainly because they were true, but because the people that did not believe in them died off. So that scientific and cultural evolution and progress kind of depends on a certain changing of the guard. And just kind of those two ideas, I wonder if you could just kind of talk about the social side of people that stick around maybe too long, maybe perhaps that this could lead to a society that's ever more conservative and that we don't socially progress based on the fact that people stick around forever.
Yeah. Again, I think it's a really interesting question. That goes to this question, well, is there some reason that we should not, and that nature should provide that we should not live forever?
Yeah, they're both very thoughtful questions. About the chickens in the centrifuge first, usually it turns out that there are some hidden trade-offs in these breeding experiments that create Methuselahs. So I haven't heard about those Methuselah chickens, but I would suspect that that has not taken over the poultry industry as you would imagine it would if it really worked as a 360-degree improvement of the chicken. I bet there were some trade-offs involved, and you see the same sorts of issues cropping up with the worms, with the flies, with the mice. So just to put that out there. But I will pick up the book. I've meant to read it for almost forever. The question that you raise about the evolution of ideas, the evolution of society requiring one generation to step aside and make room for the next and the new ideas of the next, I think that's a really well-founded question to raise. And in fact, there's a saying in science, which you may have heard, that science advances by the deaths of the old scientists. Now I'm mangling the quote. It's catchier than that. It was said by an old physicist, and so what happens when scientists don't step aside? One of the biologists I interviewed for my book is a distinguished cell biologist named Martin Raff, who argues completely the opposite side to Aubrey de Grey. Martin Raff was cheerfully willing to retire at 65, even though as a distinguished biologist at University College London, he could have hung on to his lab for many years longer, because he feels it's important for one generation to step aside and make way for the next. Aubrey, on the other hand, would like us all to – this is it. We, all of those of us now alive, are those who will be alive forever. His slogan is, why shouldn't we be our own next generation?
Hmm. Well, Ed, we're coming down to the point where we only have a couple of minutes left, I'm sorry to say. I want to go back to the story that you told about having made the appearance with Oliver Sacks, and where he said, well, after all, we're all mortal. And then, as you said, someone jumped up and said, no, that's a lie. But I think one would have to look at the evidence and say that while there are some living things that live for a long time, as far as I know, there isn't anything that lives forever, which begs this question, and it was the very first of these really big questions that you look at and we've touched on, maybe not as much as the others, that question being, well, why did we evolve to be mortal? I mean, why do we die at all? And is there some good reason for that?
That's a really big question, and in a few minutes we can't do justice to it. But first, there are a few organisms on this planet that do seem to be virtually immortal. There's one called the hydra, which is a little squid-like thing that lives in freshwater puddles and ponds. And as long as the puddle or the pond doesn't dry up or the aquarium tank, it goes on and on. It's no more likely to die at 4 years than it was at 1 year or 1 month. So it seems as if it can be done in nature. Now, why didn't we evolve along similar lines? There are very interesting arguments. I go into them in the book about the evolution of aging, and those arguments are not what you would think. It's not so much that we evolved to age to make way for the next generation. We evolved really to grow up fast and pass on our genes before we starved to death in the wild or froze to death or got swallowed by a bear. Evolution was pushing us toward being able to pass on the torch fast, because life was so dangerous in the wild that we might not get a chance to pass on that torch. And that's all that evolution really focused on in the design of our bodies. So now we live so much longer than 20, 25, and what we do with the gift of all those extra years that we've already won for ourselves, the gerontologists would argue that decision is up to us.
Hmm. Well, I think that we're just about at the point that we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry to say. Is this a story that you think you're going to continue to follow in your reporting work?
I know I'll follow it. I'm fascinated by it, but I don't think I'll write about it again. In a sense, having spent all this time listening to the immortalists, I'm more reconciled to being a mortal, David, and I'm comfortable with that. So that's where I remain.
All right. Our guest is Jonathan Weiner. He is a science writer. He has won the Pulitzer Prize for his writing, also the National Book Critics Circle Award, the LA Times Book Prize. He's written for many different publications. He teaches science writing at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. His book dealing with this subject is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. And we want to say thanks, Jonathan, for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also, we want to say thanks to Craig Hedick, who is the engineer on the other end of our high-quality connection.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring the exhibit, Sousa and His League of Players, America's Music and the Golden Age of Baseball, from the Smithsonian Institution. More information is at sousaarchives.org. WILL programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
That's about it for us on Focus. Coming up noon today, we're going to have live coverage from Springfield of the governor's budget address. I do want to mention real quick, tomorrow morning on the show in our 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the Illinois budget. Our guest will be Robert Rich. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the U of I. And right now, we'll hand things off to the host of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. And a reminder that this is Illinois Public Media, and we're breaking away a little bit earlier from Focus than we would ordinarily do, because we're going to join Illinois Public Radio at noon straight up for Illinois Public Radio coverage of Governor Pat Quinn's budget message to a joint session of the General Assembly. So let's take a look at commodity prices now. In Kansas City, March wheat is trading at 9.25 and three quarters, down 17 and three quarters. May, 9.36 and a quarter, down 18. In Chicago, March wheat, 8.29 and three quarters, down 10 and a half. May, 8.61 and a half, down 10 and three quarters. March corn, 6.86 and a half, down 4. May, 6.96 and a quarter, down 4 and three quarters. July, 7 even, down 4 and a quarter. September, 6.31 and a half, down 9. March soybeans, 13.67 and a half, down 1 half. May, 13.80, down 1 and a quarter. July, 13.87, down 1 and a half. August, 13.69 and three quarters, down 3 quarters. March meal, $3.65.60, down $1. March oil, $56.62, that's up 8. February live cattle, $108.75, down 30. April, $114.10, up 32 and a half. March feeder cattle, $129.90, up 137 and a half. And February lean hogs, $85.65, that's down 2.5. I'll give you the April contract as well, $92.45, that's down 10. On to the outside markets next. March crude, $85.15, up 83. The U.S. dollar, $78.31. Down 26. The CRB index, 338.81, up 252. The Dow is currently up 37 at 12,264, and the S&P 500 up 5 at 1333. The NASDAQ is up 14 points at 28.19. 2 minutes before noon Central Time, 52 degrees in Urbana, under mostly sunny skies. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. The forecast for East Central Illinois this afternoon, increasing cloudiness. Look for a high in the mid-50s. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with areas of drizzle and fog, the low 47, with the temperature holding steady or rising slightly after midnight. The wind will be out of the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, windy, and warm, the high 62, and the wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers. The low, 50. The wind will be from the southwest at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny with a high of 55 and a wind from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25. Friday night and Saturday, partly cloudy and cooler. The low Friday night, 30. The high Saturday, 45. 1 minute before noon, coming up next, we join Illinois Public Radio for live coverage of Governor Pat Quinn's budget message to a joint session of the General Assembly. Stay tuned.